This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
Well, I'll see you later, alligator.
See you later, alligator.
After a while, crocodile.
Some musical history from the early days of rock and roll, and a tiny piece of which is explored and celebrated in a Broadway musical called Million Dollar Quartet. It explores a moment in time in 1956 when four men who had helped define an era come together for one magical night. The show is in the middle of a three-week run in Charlotte, and we'll spend some time looking back later in the program. First, we talk about an effort to save some of today's Charlotte for posterity. The Charlotte Video Project is an effort to catalog the culture of the Queen City through documentary video. And notice I didn't say a documentary, because this effort encompasses multiple documentaries designed to be shown on an ever-expanding platform, the Internet. To tell us more, we're joined by Scott Lazis and Kevin Beatty, co-founders of the Charlotte Video Project. Scott also serves as editor, and Kevin is director of photography. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Whoa. You both talk at once.
Too close.
No, that's fine. Richard Thurman is also with us. He is editor of Charlotte Magazine, which has partnered with the Charlotte Video Project. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning. And Jeremy Markovich is a writer at the magazine who has written a companion piece to go with at least one of the documentaries being produced about Fire Station
15,
which is over on Shamrock Drive.
Yep.
Is that the only piece you've written in conjunction with this, or is this one of many?
It's the only one I've written so far.
Okay. Where did the idea for the Charlotte Video Project, the video component of this, come from?
Well, we went to high school in town here. We graduated from Hopewell, actually.
When?
Just up the road, 2007. And we each went off to college in the Northeast. And often when I told people that I was from Charlotte, I got one of two answers. It was either, Charlotte, that's near the Outer Banks, right? Or the other answer, which was, Charlotte, oh, you guys have a great airport. I love those rocking chairs. And I was in New Jersey, so it was,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you were at Rutgers. And
I was at Rutgers,
I have found, my brother lives in New Jersey, and I have found that people in New Jersey generally know where Charlotte is because all their relatives live here.
Not in my experience.
Okay.
But anyway, so I studied film and journalism. Kevin studied film at Boston University.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came time, we learned about sometime during the last semester, our last semester in this earlier this spring, that the Democratic National Convention was coming in town. We thought, hey, rather than trying to climb the production ladder in New York or out west in L.A., what if we came back to Charlotte, started our own production company, and just started making films about the city? And that's exactly what we did.
Did you find, Kevin, that the same thing in Boston, that people didn't know where we were, what we were all about, et cetera?
I heard the airport thing a lot.
Really?
And it was more so about, like, cow pastures.
We have to
like
get
that.
Well, you know, the airport thing, we can solve that. We have to get rid of those rocking chairs.
Oh, I like the rocking chairs.
Okay. But the second problem is from Days of Thunder. Do you remember that movie?
I remember
Tom Cruise, right?
Tom Cruise. It's about NASCAR. And the first shot in the film is this bucolic pasture with his old barn falling down. And then they super Charlotte, North Carolina on it. I saw red when I saw that. I think that's where that comes from, don't you think? That and the fact that the South is bucolic in the Northern psyche, in their minds.
I don't know.
So that and the DNC drove you back home to do these documentaries about Charlotte?
And to save some overhead, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot cheaper to live here.
We both believe that the culture of Charlotte has not been properly documented. Why?
Well, I think I don't know if it's been improperly documented, but at least for what we want to do, there are a lot of stories in Charlotte that don't get the exposure that we think they deserve. And so a lot of our work, especially during the summer, has been profiling artists who are sort of emerging, chefs, prominent chefs in the area, and telling stories. I mean, the style, which Kevin can talk a bit more, I think is what sets us apart from the documentation that has gone on in the city.
It also has to do with, I mean, I grew up in Huntersville, and I think I've spent more time downtown in the last, 4 months than I have in my entire life. And it was sort of the stigma, growing up, that like, Huntersville and Charlotte has nothing to do. And I'm learning that there's a lot to do. It's just, I just didn't know about it.
But you went to school in Boston.
Yeah.
Compare the two.
There's a lot going on here.
There is a lot going on here. I think you just kind of have to look for it. And what our project is trying to do is to give an image to some of the things that you may not have seen, or perhaps you've heard on this show, for instance, but it may not have seen.
So when you talk about the culture of a city, you're talking about the people who make it different. You're not talking about showing off the movers and shakers. You're talking about showing off the people who live and make this live here and make this place different from any other city.
Yeah, I think a combination of both. You know, I mean, there's definitely a very strong counterculture in this city, or countercultures in this city that we are trying to tell those stories. Mm-hmm. But there, you know, I'd love to do a story on Cam Newton or Anthony Fox or some of the people that are the prominent figures here.
Harvey Gantt,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are all things. I mean, we'll probably need to develop the project a bit more to get there, but.
Harvey's not known to be a talker, but that doesn't seem to be a problem for you. I've watched three or four of your documentaries so far, and you take what you call a fly-on-the-wall approach to this.
We're kind of quiet.
Well, yeah, you don't say anything. There's no interviewer, and there's not a lot of words in some of these pieces. It's you're just kind of hovering.
We're working as we go along to sort of fill it with more dialogue, but we don't want the fourth wall to be broken. It's more about watching what's actually unfolding rather than sort of setting it up and trying to pull out answers to make a thesis. We sort of just pick up what we can find and then put it together later.
And it's voyeuristic, I think, which seems to be in demand these days with YouTube and all the rest of it. But furthermore, the style of the videos lends itself well to print accompaniment. And so the most recent story that we worked on with Jeremy on Fire Station 15, you get the explicit view of the firefighters through the video, and more philosophical concepts or abstract concepts are discussed in the article. So what's great about it is that viewers can choose how they consume their media, whether they want to watch it or they want to read about it or they want to do both.
And
or,
at the end, it's sort of a bigger cumulative picture than you would have gotten from
one
another.
Well, if you see the video and read the articles, the companion articles that we're going to talk about, then you get a really full view of everything. And I think that's the way to do it. I don't think you could just see one or read the other and not deal with the other one, but why would you want to? And this is kind of, to me, Rick Thurman, the coming together of what's happening throughout print today, throughout the media, not just print, the convergence of everything. You're not just a magazine. You're not just a television station. You're not just a radio station. You're everything. Everybody has video. Everybody has audio clips. Everybody has print. It's merging.
Yeah, one of the terms I hear a lot is platform agnostic. meaning that we don't really care how we get the story out there as long as we tell the story and letting the reader, viewer, listener choose how they want to consume that story.
And Jeremy, your piece, I read your piece yesterday on Fire Station 15 after having watched their video. And as I said, there are not a lot of words in the video. There's no interview. The firefighters do talk. You hear them talking to each other. You hear them making wild line comments. But then in your article, it's a traditional article. I mean, you've talked to these people. You flesh it out. You take us with them. It's kind of not a duplicate, but it complements the video piece.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things that I thought about this was that sometimes you can watch a video piece, or you'll go somewhere and then you'll watch a story on the place that you went or the person that maybe you've talked to, and you're like, that doesn't seem like the same person, or that doesn't seem like the same place that I went to. And the nice thing was, I had done most of my work and then went back and watched the video, and you guys had done the video before I had actually gone out on a different day to do the story. And it was the same. It was the same kind of wisecracks. It was the same sort of urgency and just kind of frenetic pace of these guys running out on a call. And that's kind of a nice thing to see, at least as a writer, is, and I'm sure, vice versa, is that, oh, we kind of got it right. At least, if you have this other piece of evidence, I guess, or this other video piece to complement the words, and they both kind of sync, that to me really, that makes me feel better about what I've done, that you kind of get the feeling through the video that maybe you're not going to get through as many words as you can possibly
write. That's an interesting point, because I don't think people fully understand that unless they've been covered for some reason by the media, either television or newspaper or some other form of print. where they're involved in the story, and the media seeks them out, and they talk to somebody for 10 minutes, and they have five words in the story, and they think, that's not the story. That's not the story. That's not what happened. The idea is to evoke the feeling of the story, and since the two of you did this completely independently and you came up with the same feeling, that's a pretty good indication, is it not, that you've hit the mark, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I liked about Scott and Kevin's work when we first met was it's not contrived at all. You know, it's not designed. It's not, okay, here's the story. Let's go out and find that story. It's let's see what happens and then tell that story. And that's the same way we work at the magazine. We talk a lot about, you know, truth-telling, what is the story, what is the story. And, you know, I charge my writers, and Jeremy is one of the best, at just going and talking and talking and listening and listening and listening and then coming back and saying, okay, I think this is the story, rather than deciding before we do the reporting.
In reading about the videos yesterday, I came across a term that I hadn't heard in a long time, cinema verite. Mm. And I remember hearing that when I was in college back in the Paleolithic age. That was all the rage in all the art houses. You'd go see cinema verite.
Yeah.
And you're kind of using that whole thing. Now, your plan is to produce 100 of these documentaries between now and the arrival of the Democratic National Convention in
September
of next year. Why that time frame? Why is the Democratic National Convention the bookender, the book frame, the book binder, whatever the heck?
Well, the DNC obviously is a huge event, probably the biggest that the city has experienced to date. And with that comes a lot of media. And what we're producing is obviously media works. In addition to sort of piggybacking on the exposure of the DNC, while we are not hardline, you know, there is no hardline connection with the actual convention, we're piggybacking on the exposure. And furthermore, I think that these pieces as a collection, which 100 is a lot, and will give at least a somewhat comprehensive look at the city in the year before one of its biggest events, that there will be some historic value to these. You know, it's a year-long library, essentially, of video content, video documentation. In fact, when we first started this project, we called it the Charlotte Video Encyclopedia. But then we thought that was a little too academic. Right. So we changed it to the Charlotte Video Project.
Well, this is one video, if I've done the math right, every 3 or 4 days. If you're doing 100 in 365 days, that's a lot of work.
Is it 3 or 4 days?
Isn't it?
I don't know. I haven't done the math.
But if 100 goes into 365.
Okay. I was a humanities student in college, man. in addition to the documentary pieces, the more in-depth look at actual characters, we have other ideas for pieces that are more recurring, such as like a chef series featuring prominent chefs preparing their dishes. Of course, it's a break from the style that we've created, which is this verite style, right, which I'd like to talk a little bit more about in a second.
Sure.
But and then also we'd like to highlight some of the local musicians who work in town and have them just perform a song out in the street somewhere. Not street musicians per se, but established or emerging musicians in the city playing out somewhere to sort of, I guess, celebrate the cultural fabric of the city.
But I think the power of having so many videos it piggybacks on the internet, so you have a grid of content that you can choose between, and that sort of helps for what we're doing.
That's Kevin Beatty, who, along with Scott Lazies, his partner, are the Charlotte Video Project, and they're partnered with Charlotte Magazine. Richard Thurman and Jeremy Markovich are with us from that. We're going to talk about this collaborative effort that they're doing this whole year leading up to the DNC when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Southeast Anesthesiology Consultants, thanking over 30 hospital partners in the Southeast for using the Quantum Clinical Navigation System to improve patient care. SEAnesthesiology.com. And Hickory Choral Society presenting their Christmas concerts this weekend at Cometh Reformed Church in Hickory, Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday at 3 p.m. Info at hickorychoralsociety.org. Well, in the early 20th century, there was an historic migration that hasn't received a lot of attention until now. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Isabel Wilkerson has written a book that brings to life the movement of millions of African Americans from the South to the North. But she does it by telling the story through the lives of three unique people who made a courageous decision that helped change the face of more than a few American cities. The Great Migration, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, NATO promises to investigate airstrikes that killed more than 24 Pakistani soldiers. New strains for the region.
That's the topic on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source for 30 years.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I'm sitting in the studio during the break listening, witnessing convergence because we have the writer for Charlotte Magazine talking to the videographer about color correction. I mean, geez. Scott Lazis and Kevin Beatty are the Charlotte Video Project. They're attempting to produce 100 documentaries about Charlotte between now and the Democratic National Convention's arrival. Richard Thurman is editor of Charlotte Magazine. Jeremy Markovich is a writer for the magazine, and they are collaborating in this effort. When they started this, the video portion of this, in May, when did you, Richard, discover this effort, and why did you want to partner with them?
They contacted me probably about 2 or 3 months ago, I think, and we just started conversations about how this could work, how could we work together, and you know, I was struck by a few things right away. One, I've always wanted a strong video component on our website. Mm-hmm. The challenge is most print operations also want video, but they just don't do good video because it's not what we do.
Right.
So an opportunity to work with two guys doing really good work was intriguing, and that's the one thing I said to them. I said, hey, you know, your work is good, and I'm all about trying to help good work find, you know, a place in Charlotte. That's part of our mission at Charlotte Magazine. So especially when we looked at the way they were doing the videos and the way they could really work to get well with print, we just saw a natural partnership. And they'd already done some videos that matched with stories that we had already done, so I could see that their topics were lining up.
Is that because you read the magazine?
Yes.
Okay. Just checking. Honesty. Honesty here.
Okay. Doesn't everybody?
Nice.
And so right away, there was an opportunity with Cassie Parsons, the chef at Harvest Moon Grill, and also with Grateful Growers, her farm, with her partner Natalie. And we were working on a short story about her. They had done a piece on her. So right away, we in the November issue, we ran the story, promoted the short film, and ran that online. That's at our website now. And then coming up, we saw the opportunity for the firefighter or the Firehouse 15, and it just worked really well together.
You know, this leads me to a question, an economics question. I read your article, Jeremy, online, not out of the magazine. I went online and I read it there, the whole thing, and there in the box on the front page of the article, it's a 3-page article, is a little box you click, and there's the video. It's free. Both of them, both components there are there on the internet free. How do you pay for all of this? This all costs money.
We could do a series of shows on this topic. That's a great question. We pay them in cash to answer explicitly. You know, there's a lot of things about this. One, I like the way it enhances our brand, you know, to be honest. You know, the work they're doing matches our aesthetic. It enhances our brand. It makes our website a destination.
Right.
We hope to attract advertising. You know, we're working on a plan to sell advertising, you know, for the videos. And then, of course, the more traffic we get on the website, the more advertising we can sell there.
There's also another component to this, which because the videos are so flexible over the internet, they can be embedded almost anywhere. So with that brand attached to it, I mean, you're now approaching a national audience.
International, even.
International, even.
So are you putting a Charlotte Magazine bug in the corner?
There's a watermark in the right, bottom right-hand corner of the videos.
Okay. So let me get this straight. These young whippersnappers, fresh out of college, they're getting paid to put your their stuff on your website.
You got student loans, man.
Now, Fire Station 15 is
we like to pay for good work.
But Fire Station 15 is the latest of these videos to come out. I think it's the latest,
yep.
And it is the current article in the current issue of Charlotte Magazine. And neither of you communicated about this. So when you were given the assignment to go write about Fire Station 15, what were you told? Because Richard is in on this, so He's the editor. Did he tell you anything so that it could dovetail in some way?
Yeah, he told me that there was a companion video going with it, and I think the assignment, and this is kind of typical of how Richard and I work together, is that he will kind of give me a very broad assignment and say, you ought to go spend 24 hours in a firehouse. And I say, okay, and we'll go out there and see what happens. And so I go out there, and I sort of, I will talk to a couple firefighters, but it's a lot of just kind of sitting and watching and kind of not being in the way, which is, it sounds, this is how
very
you guys
similar.
Operate.
Yeah.
It's very, and I think after a while, people just, whoever your subject is kind of gets used to you. And so maybe that's why our stories kind of seem like they work very well together, because I think our styles kind of came together in the same way. But there was kind of very little instruction at the very beginning, and it was just go out and see what happens over a one-day period at a firehouse, and that's what I did. And so that's kind of how it kind of dovetailed and came together.
This occurred to me yesterday as I was reading the piece and also watching the video, and it only occurred to me because it was about a fire station. Is CBS, on the anniversary of 9/11, aired a documentary following firefighters into the towers.
Oh, yeah. I heard about this.
And they got that footage, the documentary filmmakers who produced that. They weren't with CBS. CBS bought the rights to air it. They were only able to do that because they were doing a similar documentary. They had just decided to picked a fire station at random and lived with those guys for like a month, doing exactly what you did, and happened to be brought in on this story of the 9/11 towers. And one of the things in your article and in your video piece that it comes through loud and clear is that these guys are firefighters because they want to fight fires.
Yeah.
And fires never happen here.
Not often.
Well, yeah. And they're experts who don't always get to, practice their expertise.
To do what they do.
There was, I looked up the numbers on Engine 15 for how many calls that they run, and they ran about 4,800 calls in 2010. 4.7% were fires. Mm-hmm. And these aren't, this isn't the towering inferno. The only fire call that I went on was a pile of burning clothing that was out in front of a house, and that was it. Mm-hmm. The rest, 60%, are medical calls. And so that is kind of what their reality is now, is that they train for fires, they go through the academy, and they come out, and they really want to use that training, but they barely ever do. So anytime they hear fire over the loudspeaker, they are moving so fast, you can't keep up.
Yeah, it's sort of a win-win, though, because we have fewer fires in town, which not a bad thing.
Right.
But when they happen, we have guys that are ready to go.
The Charlotte Video Project started before they had the relationship with Charlotte Magazine. But now that you do have this relationship, are you getting together to help choose the topic of the next story, the next documentary, or is everybody independent of everybody else?
Well, we have about 10 projects that are either finished or very close to finish. And Rick is, I think, aware of either both those and prospective story ideas. This particular story was, we did the video. Rick said he wanted to do a story. I'd been wanting to do a story on the fire station, and Jeremy wrote very beautifully on it. I'd like to do a piece where a writer does a story and then we go out and do a video for it. I mean, I think that would be very exciting.
Any ideas to do that?
Yeah, we've got a few we're working on.
Which you're keeping close to the belt, so that the observer doesn't steal them from you.
I'm not familiar with that publication.
How do you choose your topics?
Great question. So basically two things. We want our subjects, or hope that our subjects, are passionate about what they do. But furthermore, we look for subjects that contribute somehow to the cultural fabric of the city in whatever way that whatever that means, and that's basically it. I mean, things that we think are interesting, basically.
And you're the videographer,
right?
It's cinema verite, so I mean, they're nicely shot. I mean, do you spend any time setting up the shots or lighting the shots, or do you just point the camera and go, because that's what's happening right now?
Well, I set it up. I think about it, where I'm putting the camera, but I come from a still background in still photography, so I'm kind of used to that. it's really just about sort of like making sure I watch the back of my camera so they don't see my eyes, and then I kind of just disappear.
Now, why is 100? You're shooting 100 videos between now and the Democratic National Convention. Why is 100 the magic number?
Well, again,
it's a good number.
It's a good number.
Because
they
didn't do the math.
That's yeah, right. We should have taken a math class in college. Well, it's a good selling point. It's a comprehensive number, I think. 100 short films about Charlotte will tell at least somewhat of the story of the city.
But you decided to start this before you had any kind of monetary relationship. So where did you think, how did you think you'd be able to do this? Because you're two guys out of college. You said you had student loans. I mean, Rutgers is not cheap.
We're artists, so we kind of just start making stuff and hope it works.
Yeah, that's true.
You didn't take an economics class in college either, did you?
No. I told you, man, humanities, that was it. We could talk about Foucault if you want.
So what happens to these once you've done the 100, once the companion articles, because you only come out once a month.
Yeah,
so there won't be 100 articles.
No.
So when you've done the 100 videos and you've done the 12 articles, what happens to all this history of Charlotte that you are collecting? Where does it go? Where does it live after that?
Well, at the moment, we're looking for other publications who are interested in similar types of content.
You hear that, Rick?
It's a big world.
But at the same time, we've also thrown around the idea of finding a way to partner with libraries to sort of archive this stuff, having screenings. And during the DNC week, we're hoping to sort of be able to showcase all this stuff while there's a lot of people in town.
Yeah, physical screenings would be great to have. I mean, it would be, I imagine seeing screens playing our stuff, because it's so visual, you don't necessarily have to have sound to enjoy it. That was kind of the thinking with the Verite style, was that people at work, for instance, who are, don't necessarily have access to sound, can read the article, watch the video without their speakers on, and still, get a lot of the information.
And still not work.
And still not.
Still goof off.
Yeah, still goof off.
In their cubicle.
Yeah.
We don't really consider reading Charlotte Magazine to be goofing off.
Well, no, but at work.
It's academic.
At work, it is. You can see, you can read the article in Charlotte Magazine, or you can go to the Charlotte Magazine website and read the article and click on the video. Where are the other videos at the moment that you've already done that are not associated with articles? How
They're
can people
hiding.
See them?
They're hiding.
So you can't see them?
No, you can't see
so
them.
So I got a backdoor pass yesterday to see them. Is that
you
what
did.
You're telling me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have more information about the Charlotte Video Project on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks, and I guess we'll continue to look for what's in the January issue. What of their efforts is going to be in the January issue?
We've got a couple of things we're talking about. We're not completely confirmed yet.
You're playing it close to the vest with me.
Well, I don't want to promise something that might not happen.
Richard Thurman is editor of Charlotte Magazine. Jeremy Markovich wrote the article about Fire Station 15 in the current issue. And Scott Lazis and Kevin Beatty are co-founders, the editor and director of photography, respectively, of the Charlotte Video Project. Thank you all for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, on to a piece of music history that took place in Memphis in the early days of rock and roll.
On December 4th, 1956, one man brought Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Elvis Presley to play together for the first and only time. That man was me, Sam Phillips. The place was Sun Records. And that night, we made rock and roll history.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show. Three to get ready. Well, now go, cat, go. But don't you step on my blue suede shoes. Well, you can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes.
Million Dollar Quartet is the Broadway musical based on the coming together of those four primal forces in the music that would transform the 20th century. In the middle of a three-week run at the Knight Theater, the show is both a history lesson and a celebration that will not only open your eyes to the beginning of an era, but also rock your socks off.
Blue suede shoes, and you can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes.
Well, we don't have Elvis, Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, or Jerry Lee Lewis in the studio with us, but we do have some guys who come frighteningly close. It's amazing, actually. Lee Ferris plays Carl Perkins. Derek Keeling is Johnny Cash. Billy Woodward is Elvis in some performances of this show. And Austin Cook is Jerry Lee Lewis in some performances of this show, because everybody has understudies, and we have two of the understudies and two of the guys here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
This is a show that I had no real affinity for, because this is slightly before my era. Way before yours. And I went with some trepidation, because I thought, what am I going to think about this? And I loved it. It is just, it's just fun from start to finish. And it's a history lesson.
That's true.
How'd you pull that off?
A lot of luck. Good casting. No, I
YouTube videos, books,
well, yeah,
recordings.
Because I knew you were young, but I read your bios yesterday, and some of you are really young. I mean, are you out of your teens? Are you, you're 20, right?
Oh, yeah.
How old are you?
I'm 25.
25. And you're...
I'm old enough.
We're a little older.
Because I was going to ask, do you remember these people?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up with, like, my dad was a drag racer, and we go on these long road trips, and we just listen to 50s music the whole time. I mean, I know I didn't grow up in the 50s, but... I grew up in the 80s, and we listened to all the 50s music the entire time. That's all I was allowed to listen to, mm-hmm. So it really made a big influence on my life.
You're all musicians.
It's true.
Musicians first and foremost, or do some of you consider yourselves actors first and foremost, musicians second, or the other way around? What's the story here?
I came from a musician's background. They saw me at a show with my band, and... Mm-hmm. Came up, pulled me in for an audition. So
it's Billy Woodward who plays Elvis, and you kind of have that pompadour going. Did you have that pompadour before you did this show?
I did. It kind of went away for a bit. Got the show, and it's back in full force. Yeah, 10W-40. It's a lot of.
And Billy, that is Billy Austin.
Yeah,
over here. Sorry, go ahead.
No,
so confused.
Yeah, I was definitely a pianist, I would say, foremost. I had strong classical piano background, and I was doing classical piano concertos before this, so it's quite a contrast.
So when you're playing Jerry Lee Lewis and you're going up and down that keyboard ripping your thumbnails off,
yep, basically,
and playing on top of the piano backwards, what in your classical background prepared you for that?
Breaking the rules, basically. That's what it's about, you know, rocking out, breaking the rules. So.
What about the two of you? Derek Keeling plays Johnny Cash, Lee Ferris is Carl Perkins. I've seen some videos of you.
Oh, yeah?
You're not at all like Carl Perkins.
Not at all.
In your real life.
No, but I think, I come from mostly a musician's background as well. I studied jazz composition at Berklee College of Music for guitar and as a principal instrument, and voice as well, some classical voice. I feel like with Carl Perkins that it's such a ubiquitous style in our culture musically that it kind of has been entrenched in everything that we do, especially the Johnny Cash stuff that he played on, and blues in general is just such a huge part of everything that we do that we don't even know it. I mean, the music you hear on the radio and the music you hear in films and everything has been influenced by these gentlemen who started this kind of entire revolution.
Yeah, I don't think people think about it until they see this show and they realize. I'll play some examples of some of the music in the show that helps you open your eyes to the fact that these guys were seminal in so many different ways.
Yes.
Even they didn't know it, did they?
Yeah.
No, they would have no idea.
Yeah.
Yet.
Yeah, well, they were at the birthplace of rock and roll and what it is now. And like, so, yeah, when you're in it, you don't really realize it because you're living it.
Exactly. We have to take a break. We're going to come back with more conversation and more music from Million Dollar Quartet in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeastern University, whose global innovative approach to experiential learning now offers flexible professional graduate education degrees in Charlotte. Details at northeastern.edu/Charlotte. And Utility, the Duke Energy website, empowering customers to take control of their energy use. Details at duke-energy.com/YOUtility. NATO says it will investigate airstrikes that killed more than 24 Pakistani soldiers, what new strains mean for the region, and U.S. strategy in Afghanistan, the topic at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And we're going to continue our conversation with the Million Dollar Quartet. And if you'd like to join it, you can, 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, or online, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Chances are you listen to WFAE at least an hour a day. That's 365 hours a year, the equivalent of seeing 243 movies or enjoying 185 romantic dinners. You've received a lot of value from WFAE this year, so please give something back. If you've received a letter asking you for a gift, please mail your check today or make a year-end tax-deductible gift at WFAE.org. Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks. We're here with the Million Dollar Quartet, which is all about Johnny Cash, Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Carl Perkins.
Say one present tender kiss, sweet, sweet memories you gave to me. Add one stolen night of bliss, sweet, sweet memories you gave to me. One girl.
You forget that Elvis became Elvis over a stretch of time. And I believe in the show that that's an example of him imitating Dean Martin's style of singing, if I recall correctly. We're here with the guys who play all these people in Million Dollar Quartet, which is at the Knight Theater until December the 11th. They're in the middle of a three-week run. Lee Ferris plays Carl Perkins, about whom nobody knows anything that I've talked to.
Yeah. That's totally the truth. There's so much freedom.
Although Doug Mays, who is a legend in this market in broadcasting, wrote a note to a friend of mine about this show and said he remembers interviewing Carl Perkins at WBT in what was then a closet of a studio, because I guess he wasn't anybody, so he didn't get the big studio. Derek Keeling plays Johnny Cash. Billy Woodward is Elvis, and Austin Cook is Jerry Lee Lewis. This never happens when touring shows come through here. We never get live performances. Never.
Oh, the Million Dollar Quartet, we go above and beyond, always.
Evidently, because you have Derek, brought your guitar with you.
I have your
Johnny Cash guitar. And the other thing that we learned in this musical is that rock and roll, in the beginnings, was really kind of tame, because these guys were coming at it from all different angles, and particularly Johnny Cash, and I think to a certain degree Jerry Lee Lewis, had this background of gospel and spiritual music, and so did Elvis.
Yeah, well, really, that's why a lot of these guys get along and were able to sit in a jam session, because they have that in common. They knew all these songs growing up. They played them all growing up, so when they get together, they can just kind of, you know, they go off the fly, because that's what they all know, the same songs, because they were all religious, you know, upbringing.
And when you listen to the original recordings from December 4th, 1956, which are available on iTunes and such, it's just mostly gospel music. Mm. It's just them kind of getting together and harmonizing those classic church harmonies and things.
We should mention that the premise of this show, it's based on a true story where these four guys came together at Sun Records one night in 1956 and recorded on the fly. By happenstance. In fact, they weren't there to record. They just recorded what was going on.
Actually, Carl was there to record.
It was a Carl Perkins recording session scheduled as the comeback to Blue Suede Shoes that he wrote the year prior.
Yeah, Carl Perkins' story is a sad story, because he wrote Blue Suede Shoes. It was a monster hit, but it was a monster hit for Elvis, because Carl had a traffic accident.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what happened. He did have quite a bit of success in all three markets of country, blues, and R&B at the time, which was the first kind of cross, counter hit across a bunch of different markets. But yes, he got in a bad accident when he was going to play that song on the Perry Como television show in somewhere in Vermont, I believe, and ended up in Delaware in hospital, and it was really quite tragic, and set his career back, and as well as his brother's, for at least a year.
So instead, Elvis got to sing it on Ed Sullivan, and the rest is history.
And he performed it a couple times, too.
So you guys are actually going to sing live, and because you walked in here and sat down in the course of 30 seconds, we haven't had a chance to do any kind of sound check to see how this is going to work out. So we're going to mix it on the fly, as you said.
We're used to that, too. It's all good.
School. So here we go. What are you going to do?
It's a little Riverside, a little gospel.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to lay down with my burden.
Well,
down by the riverside. Down by the riverside. Down by the riverside, I'm gonna lay down my burden.
Where?
Down by the riverside, I'm gonna study war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study
war no more, well, I ain't gonna study war no more, ain't gonna study war no more, ain't gonna study war no more.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield.
Say what?
Down by the riverside.
Where?
Down by the riverside.
Where?
Down by that riverside.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield.
Down by the riverside. I'm gonna study war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more, no more, no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more.
Whoa.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, good early morning. In the morning. Hard to do that early in the morning. Well, thank you for doing that, as a matter of fact. That was very nice of you and very unexpected. I want to play, just to give people the flavor of this, because this is the music of these four gentlemen when they're just starting out. This is before Las Vegas for Elvis, although he had done a stint in Elvis. I'm in Vegas, and it didn't go well, evidently.
Didn't go well at all, yeah. He was used to screaming fans, you know. He right. goes there, and light applause.
Light applause. After,
yeah,
because they're used to Sinatra back then, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So this is very early, and I want to play a medley of songs from the show to put you in the era that this show takes place in.
Boys, it's coming upon Christmas, and we got lots to celebrate. Cause it ain't every day I get me a by God $1 million quartet in my studio.
Well, I'm sitting here wondering the matchbox is holding my clothes. I'm sitting here wondering the matchbox is holding my clothes. I ain't got a lot of matches, I got a long way to go.
You know, you can say it's the devil's music. You can say it ain't even music at all, but there are times when we're in here working on a song hour upon hour, and those boys give it 10% more than what they thought they had. And I think, my God, this is where the soul of a man never dies.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
You look at a God-given talent. These fingers of mine got brains in them.
Well, come on over, baby. A whole lot of shaking going on. I said, I come on over, baby. Well, baby, you can't go wrong. We play.
One of the things you can't see in that little medley is that the guitar solo is carried by Carl Perkins, who evidently was a terrific guitar player and created a sound almost all of his own. He created that whole sound of guitar that we've come to remember from 50s rock and roll. It was him.
And we've come to remember it as rockabilly at this point.
Yes, but rockabilly.
Yeah, it's a blending of blues and country music that became rock and roll, and then because of that country hillbilly twang to it as well, rockabilly is where that came from.
Now, that's the voice of Lee Ferris, who plays Carl Perkins in the show. We've alluded to the fact that nobody really remembers much about Carl Perkins, but evidently he was a fabulous musician and helped really to make this music come alive. How would you describe, however, your own music? Because Lee Ferris, you are a musician in your own right outside of this show.
I have most of my original music is very much based in Americana, music influenced by these guys. a lot of gospel style kind of influence, like a lot of harmonious stuff, tons of harmonies, acoustic guitars, piano. I was hugely influenced by Bob Dylan, Van Morrison when I was growing up, the band. A lot of 60s Americana as well.
Because when these touring companies come through, we only have the Broadway cast recordings. I like to try and go out and find the people that we're actually talking to. And this is Lee Ferris.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away. No, please don't take my sunshine away. The other night, dear, while I lay sleeping, I dreamed I had you in these arms. When I walked here, I wasn't staking, so I hung my head.
This is audio from a video that's on the internet, and I have a question about the video.
Yes.
It's you sitting facing the camera, and behind you is a table. Seated at the table is a woman on the left, a woman in the back, and a guy on the right, and they're all at their computers completely ignoring you. I'm just curious about...
Absolute whim. It was an absolute whim. My girlfriend at the time, she said, you know, you should really record You Are My Sunshine the way you do it, because you bring out, it's become, oh, it's a kid's song and it's just a happy song. But there's a real tragic melancholy to that song that I really love, Lost Love and all of that. So the irony, I think, of having a very deadpan younger generation group of people behind me just looking at a computer while there was this soulful song in front of me, I just figured was a really nice juxtaposition.
That's what I got from it. I appreciated the irony of it. Good. I really did. All right, let's move on to somebody else sitting at the table here. We'll embarrass them. Billy Woodward, we found something from you late last night, because I didn't know you were coming till late last night. And evidently, you are a music sensation in Washington, D.C., and this is Billy Woodward. And what's the name of your group?
Billy Woodward and the Senders.
And the Senders. Evocative of that era. You really look like this kind of music.
Yeah, you know, I'm the same as Derek in the fact that I grew up with that stuff as well. You know, car rides with Pops, nothing but 50s rock and roll, so decided in 04 to kind of play that stuff.
Derek may have grown up with that in the car, but Derek is known to many who don't know that they know him because of Grease. You're the One That I Want.
Oh, that was amazing. Thinking about our young years, there was only you and me. We were young and wild and free. Now nothing can take you away from me. We've been down that road before, but that's over now. You keep me coming back for more. Baby, you're all that I want.
goes my baby. She knows how to rock and roll. She drives me crazy.
I won't get a chance to ask this ever again. Were they really screaming at you, or did they tell them to scream at you?
They were really screaming. It was crazy. Being on that show was nuts. Like we had these people that would just come in. Our audiences there were insane, and it's like we were like the Beatles or something. It was nuts. I couldn't believe it.
Now, you didn't win that competition.
I did not.
The guy who did win it did the show on Broadway and has completely disappeared, and here you are touring. So
yeah. Well, I ended up doing the show on Broadway too.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So was it a crushing blow when you didn't win, or did?
You know what? I mean, different things came out of that because I didn't win. Because I didn't win, I was able to do a show called A Tale of Two Cities, which was like a classical musical that I've always wanted to do. And some other things came out of that too. And then at the end, I got to play Danny in Grease anyway. So I was glad that it all worked out the way it was supposed to.
And Austin, next time you visit us, make sure you have a website that I can steal something from.
That's right.
Otherwise, I would have. A Million Dollar Quartet, these are the guys who play. It's a wonderful show. It's just wonderful. I mean, it's...
Thank you so much.
It's just fun, and you learn stuff, and it's based on a true story about Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, Elvis, and Jerry Lee Lewis on one night in 1956 that really kind of changed everything. It plays through December 11th at the Blumenthal, blumenthalarts.org, 372-1000. Thanks.